It's my pleasure now to introduce Solicitor General David Collins. Dr. Collins, I haven't got any record of when you were made Solicitor General, but I have here that you were QC in 2000, Senior Privy Council seven Privy Council appearances. You specialise in health law, a member of the Wellington Crown Prosecution Panel, Chair of the ACC, Chair of the Health Practitioners, something or other, I don't know whether, an Honorary Fellow of the Victoria University Law School. So, Dr. Collins, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Frank. I've been the Solicitor General for 3 years, and there are many, many wonderful features to the position. Not the least of which is that I am in the very fortunate position of being able to employ some of the most outstanding graduates and young lawyers in New Zealand. And I'd like to pay a particular tribute to one who has been responsible for preparing the paper, which I'm about to deliver. So thank you very much, Greg. I'm indebted to you for your efforts. I did feel somewhat apprehensive about accepting this invitation, given that it is my direct responsibility to try and uphold the laws of contempt in New Zealand. And I felt that walking into this environment, I might not be as welcome as I am when I walk into some other environments. But then I reflected on the fact that some of my predecessors in office, when discharging their responsibilities, have literally been hung, drawn and quartered. And I figured that if they could go through that ordeal, it would be very remiss of me not to accept the invitation to speak to you. Undoubtedly, the law of contempt features very, very highly in my list of challenges. I think trying to manage the law of contempt in the current environment ranks up there with the challenges of trying to manage vexatious and querulant litigants. It is very time-consuming, very resource-intensive, and involves a greatly disproportionate amount of my time. We've discussed, of course, many of the features of the Internet, but one of the features of the Internet which I think makes it quite unique is that governments around the world have found themselves terribly under-resourced and at a technological disadvantage when compared with the general public. And this is probably the first time in human history that governments or the leaders of society have actually been behind the eight ball. The Internet, which is so effectively has so effectively democratized communications, business, entertainment, research and science, and has provided such great benefits for the world's population, poses for governments and for persons in my position enormous challenges in trying to find means of upholding the rule of law. And these challenges are challenges for which the state is not currently well equipped or accustomed. Today I wish to touch on a number of means by which my office and the courts can try and manage contempt in the online world. First, I wish to discuss my general role in my responsibilities for protecting fair trial rights and the integrity of the courts. I'll then examine some of the hot topics of prejudicial publicity, suppression orders, and their effectiveness, and in particular the jurisdiction that the courts possess to combat contempt involving overseas entities. And then finally, I wish to engage in some discussion about practical solutions that might be taken up by branches of government to try and prevent contempt and protect the courts from abuse. So dealing firstly with the role of the Solicitor General in this particular area. The Solicitor General's involvement in the law of contempt arises from convention established through case law and not as a result of any statutory obligation. It is customary in jurisdictions comparable to New Zealand for one of the law officers, that's either the Attorney General or the Solicitor General, to assume the primary responsibility of considering and acting on complaints of contempt of court. And in New Zealand, it's the Solicitor General rather than the Attorney General who performs that task. It is more common to see the Solicitor General involved in cases of so-called criminal contempt, for example, pretrial publicity, contempt and scandalising the court, but it is equally open to the Solicitor General to commence a proceeding for what would be traditionally classified as a civil contempt, namely breaches of court order directed at parties in civil litigation. And in recent years, there have been a number of examples of civil contempt, such as Solicitor General against Moody, also known as Miss Ellis, and the many SEMA proceedings. Most of the complaints of contempt dealt with by the Solicitor General are, in fact, not matters that could or should be treated as contempt, but are straightforward and are often inadvertent breaches of name suppression orders. Crown Law's standard response to these complaints is to suggest that if the matter is of concern, then the police have the jurisdiction to be able to deal with the matter by way of expeditious summary prosecution. In other instances where no summary offence provision exists, I am prepared to consider breach of suppression orders as possibly constituting contempt, but only where they are plainly deliberate, ongoing, or where the offender is a recidivist. As all have mentioned, one significant challenge for the person who holds the office of Solicitor General in the current environment is protecting fair trial rights. Public statements that may prejudice a jury or raise untested facts should be avoided. There may be a wide variety of reasons why such alleged facts will not be before the courts, and the public should not treat all information about a case as being gospel. The public must be aware that our judicial system relies on evidence being tested in court and not in the local cafe or over talkback radio or through the blogs sites that we have discussed. The jury members who dedicate their valuable time to a trial must be given the opportunity to adjudicate on the case safe in the knowledge that the evidence being presented before them is subject to the standards of admissibility and relevance and not simply gossip. It is for this reason that some suppression orders for pretrial rulings are made. Not every suppression order is made in order to prevent prejudicial pretrial publicity. Recently, there has been wide media coverage of the effect and use of suppression orders, and the Law Commission has released a timely report on the matter. Suppression and non-publication orders may be made on a general basis or imposed by statute, such as to protect the identity of victims of sexual offences or child witnesses, as well as on an individual basis, for example, to protect the identity of convicted persons for whom publicity would have a disproportionately severe effect. I also wish to touch on the topic of scandalising, which is another, albeit very rare, means by which courts can protect their own integrity through contempt jurisdiction. A court can find someone in contempt for making a statement that is likely to lower the authority of a judge or court. The rationale is that public confidence in the court system should not be unjustifiably undermined. This allows for a wide-ranging tool to combat unjust and unqualified statements made about the judiciary. The Solicitor General has a particular responsibility for bringing instances of scandalising the court to the court's attention. Past examples have included calling a court decision blatantly wrong, obscene, unfathomable on national radio, and implying in a tabloid newspaper that a Catholic judge treated a Catholic defendant favourably. So how do we sanitise every comment made about a trial, and how can we prevent every unfavourable comment about a judge or court? The truth is, we simply cannot, and the law of contempt does not seek to do so. Everyone is entitled to freedom of expression under the Bill of Rights Act, limited only as far as is demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. We can all agree that that is a worthy aim and a right worth protecting. The challenge lies in balancing the competing interests between, on the one hand, protecting freedom of speech, and on the other hand, protecting the right to a fair trial before an independent and impartial court, and protecting against willful breaches of suppression orders. Not every criticism of the court should be held up in contempt. Judges are expected to wear some degree of personal criticism and can be open to public scrutiny, and where decisions are in fact incorrect, we have appeal rights. The Judicial Conduct Commissioner is another path by which complaints about the judiciary can be aired. But where members of the public make unfounded but potentially believable accusations against judges or the court system as a whole, it may be necessary to take action to ensure that public confidence in the integrity of the court process is not unduly damaged. For this reason, I'm not inclined to pursue every instance of scandalising or every comment that comments on a trial in progress. Furthermore, pursuing these matters through the court sometimes provides a platform to the person making the statement, which is exactly what some people seek, and that works against the aim of preventing undue publicity about the court process. So it's against that background that I want to now go on and consider some particular challenges posed by the internet. I'll deal firstly with prejudicial publicity. Occasionally, instances arise where the publication of information, either during or before trial, may prejudice a fair trial, and contempt proceedings will be considered. Not every instance of contempt is founded on a breach of the suppression order, indeed, most probably are not. By and large, newspaper editors know the bounds of the contempt laws and realise the effect of their stories. Occasionally, an established newspaper or media outlet will publish material that is sufficiently serious to warrant a charge of contempt of court. And the prosecution of Fairfax in 2007 and 2008 is testament to that process. And it was evident in the proceedings that what followed from a high level, what followed was that a high level of thought, editorial control and legal advice went into the decision to publish details of the so-called PASCO affidavit from the Operation 8 activities in the Euro wearers. The challenge arising in conveying the seriousness of that message to those members of the public who use their own websites, blogs or sites such as Twitter or Facebook. These are the people who may have a similar level of readership as established newspaper outlets, a readership which may be more willing to trust and be sympathetic to the views of the writer. A few examples will illustrate this. In 2006, the high-profile case of Rickards, the former assistant police commissioner and two former police officers who were found not guilty of historic sexual assault. The jury was not permitted to hear that two former officers had recently been convicted of sexual offences relating to incidents that had occurred in 1989, and that all three faced a further trial for indecent assault in relation to another complainant. However, this did become public knowledge. Some 4,001 posts relating to the trial were made on TradeMe in a one-month period during and immediately after the trial. Some 6 weeks before, the media finally won the right to report the suppressed facts that had already been widely disseminated on the internet. In the event, no action was taken against any members of the public, despite evidence of at least one orchestrated campaign to deliberately breach the suppression orders. The jury in the trial, as we know, had acquitted all three defendants. Another example involves the more recent trial of Clayton Weatherston. The facts don't bear repeating. We know that the jury delivered a guilty verdict, despite the accused's attempts to claim provocation. Before the verdict was rendered, David Farrar's Kiwi blog contained some comments that commented on the trial and were symptomatic of widespread public disgust at the accused's attempts to use what was considered to be an inappropriate defence. David's blog attracts, I understand, about 1 million page views per month and often receives hundreds of comments per day. This is but one example of the power of the new media, the emerging means by which news and information is now conveyed to our society. It is both exciting and sometimes, for me at least, frightening that within seconds of any given event, one person's comments can reach an audience as wide as those possessed by television or newsprint, but without the level of editorial oversight. Those in my position should always play a part in promoting education and protecting the legal process. Writing to those who are at risk of committing serious breaches of suppression orders and identifying particular concerns about online material is one means by which my duties are discharged. The more serious instances of contempt will be met with by proceedings where appropriate. Those proceedings usually attempt to establish a line in the sand for online publishers that will clarify aspects of the law that need revision or expansion in our modern society. can I make some comments about suppression orders? Suppression orders are one of the weapons in the court's arsenal to protect a fair trial and to ensure that the legal process does not unduly damage the people involved, such as instances of victim name suppression. I welcome the Law Commission's latest review of suppression orders and hope that the media reporting, is aided by clarity in the law and of any other orders affecting a trial. I note also that the Law Commission's recent recommendation that where an internet service provider or content host becomes aware that they are carrying on hosting information that they know to be in breach of a court suppression order, it should be an offence for them to fail to remove the information or to fail to block access to it as soon as is reasonably practicable. Suppression orders are a practical means to proactively manage contempt issues. They are a necessary and justifiable restriction on the right to freedom of expression. The court usually only receives one chance to get it right. Most suppression orders expire at the end of the trial, which means that freedom of expression is curtailed only to the extent necessary to protect a fair trial. Again, we must keep our eye on the touchstone of balancing the right of a fair trial against the need to protect freedom of expression. Furthermore, suppression orders can be a valuable tool in protecting witnesses from harm and protecting some, in fact very few, convicted persons of undue publicity. It appears that it was not until 2005 that New Zealand courts began including the word internet as a standard phrase in most suppression orders. That was 5 years after the Court of Appeal in Lewis against Wilson and Horton had grappled with the effect of suppression orders in the internet age, and quite a number of years after the majority of New Zealanders had acquired access to internet connection. It may be that the courts need to be more proactive and intervene in realising the challenges that lie ahead of them. His Honour David Harvey's decision in Kay is an example of just that. His Honour limited the media's ability to report certain proceedings in the youth court to a more traditional means of reporting, that is through newsprint, television and radio, but prohibited reports of the proceedings from publication over the internet. It was noted quite rightly that digital technologies such as the internet provide a significantly greater preservative and disseminatory power than print. The ability to retrieve and spread suppressed information over the internet long after that material has vanished from readily accessible newsprint or television broadcasts is unprecedented. I believe that any effort made to strike an appropriate balance between freedom of the press and fair trial rights by taking into account the unique nature of the internet is to be commended. Whether partial suppression orders will be appropriate on a more widespread basis is for the courts to decide. Provided the courts continue to issue effective and practical suppression orders to deal with various issues in the online world, the appropriate authorities will be able to play their part in prosecuting the serious cases of breaches of those orders. I now want to deal briefly with the jurisdiction and enforcement of court orders. Crown law has in the past attempted to enforce the effect of suppression orders obtained in New Zealand against a private company in another jurisdiction where that company hosted material on an overseas website. One instance involved the online publication of material which the Crown Law Office considered to be a contempt of court. The website in question was hosted by a company owned by Yahoo, Inc., as you know, an American provider of web services, and was registered by Melbourne IT through Yahoo as its reseller. As well as filing contempt of court proceedings in New Zealand against the publisher of the material, we requested that Yahoo remove the person's site through private correspondence with Yahoo and Melbourne IT. Yahoo declined to remove the site on the following grounds. Firstly, Yahoo considered that its services were delivered in the United States and Yahoo was not subject to the jurisdiction of the New Zealand courts. Secondly, the law surrounding freedom of speech in the United States were, to quote Yahoo, completely different, close quotes, to those of the Commonwealth nations. And thirdly, the Communications Decency Act of 1996 did not allow Yahoo to be treated as the publisher of content of a third-party user of its services, and Yahoo was said by them not to be involved in the development of the content of the website. Obviously, it was disappointing in the sense that some overseas internet services providers considered that their services are delivered only in their country of origin and not more broadly. Lessons in managing online contempt can be learned from the field of defamation. The decision of the High Court of Australia in Dow Jones and Company against Gutnick was the first final appellate decision on cross-border defamation over the internet. Dow Jones's publication of Barron's Online in New York and New Jersey was accessed by a number of people in Mr. Gutnick's home state of Victoria, Australia. Barron's Online contained material which Mr. Gutnick alleged was defamatory of him. Gutnick established that in Australia, publication occurs whenever and wherever an item is downloaded from the internet, i.e. automatically within the plaintiff's jurisdiction, if viewed there. This multiple publication rule is to be compared to the single publication rule of the United States. That is, publication of defamatory material only occurs once. The multiple publication rule in defamation also applies in the United Kingdom as well as in New Zealand. Fortunately for Mr. Gutnick, Dow Jones had a substantial online and physical presence in Victoria. Likewise, many publishers in New Zealand operate New Zealand websites over the domain name over which the domain name commissioner can exercise some control. However, there are times when contemptuous material is posted solely on an overseas website, sufficient to raise the concerns of my office and the judiciary. The publication of that material may occur in New Zealand, but one, the poster may be overseas and not easily subject to the jurisdiction of New Zealand, and two, the material would not, if published in the United States at least, be considered to be contemptuous in that jurisdiction. The multiple publication rule seems appropriate to me. Overseas internet service providers such as Yahoo should be deemed to deliver their services to and in New Zealand for the purposes of contempt of court. But contempt proceedings will still rely on there being a local defendant. Should these proceedings be allowed to take place in the defendant's absence? Should defendants be compelled to appear from other jurisdictions, say by video link? Must we come up with more effective means to enforce judgments overseas, such that overseas service providers and publishers take on board the seriousness of their actions in this country? These questions highlight the problems that courts will face if we continue to rely predominantly on contempt of court proceedings for serious breaches of suppression orders or in cases of prejudicial publicity. I do not wish to suggest for one moment that all internet service providers will necessarily be in contempt for merely hosting such material, but it seems out of step with modern reality and the nature of the internet that a provider such as Yahoo can seek to shed all responsibility for being a host, particularly in circumstances where the matter is brought to their attention by a responsible body. I just want to make a few comments about futility. There will be instances where the courts find themselves at a loss to protect a fair trial, despite the range of tools available to them. It is well established and well justified principle that the courts will not lend their efforts to futility. The internet has brought this problem to the fore and has greatly enlarged the number of situations in which the court cannot act once the horse has bolted. Near instantaneous publication of information after an event prohibits the courts from regulating the publication of that information. For example, news can be on the internet suggesting a named individual may be connected with a crime within minutes of a suspect being spoken to by the police or arrested, or of that person making their first appearance in court. There will often have been no opportunity for counsel to request suppression or for the court to make an order. By this means, the court's practical ability to exercise its own discretion and jurisdiction is thwarted, as the information has already passed into the public domain. Even if the court would otherwise have made a suppression order, there would be no point in doing so. Another comparable example of this type of futility in New Zealand is the case of Solicitor General against Moody, where Dr. Moody published the so-called Butcher Report online in breach of his undertaking to the court. This was held to constitute contempt. The High Court had previously held that there was no point ordering the removal of the report, however, as it was already in the public domain as a result of Dr. Moody's actions. Futility also arises in the form whereby so many publishers have published on the internet that taking enforcement proceedings against one of them, or a handful of them, becomes impossible. all publishers cannot be proceeded against, and selecting only some becomes an arbitrary exercise. As a result, no action is taken, even if the publication in question is significantly damaging. There is no easy answer to overcome futility. By definition, there may be none. The court should strive at all costs to avoid ending up in a situation where nothing can be done to adequately protect fair trial rights, particularly as it has a duty to do just that. Courts employ a range of measures to protect trials, including suppression orders, jury directions, delaying the trial, changing venue, severance, and holding trials by judge alone. Let me just finish off briefly with some thoughts about future measures to combat contempt. In order to effectively protect fair trial rights and prosecute breaches of suppression orders in an online world, it is incumbent upon us to fashion new means of engaging with overseas internet service providers and governments. The ability to effectively combat contempt across borders requires an approach from all branches of government, and the burden should not rest on the courts alone. One starting point is to establish informal agreements with police or law officers such that we can identify in overseas jurisdictions so as to try and ensure that overseas websites are aware of and comply with orders in comparable jurisdictions. It may be, for example, that the United States Attorney General will have far more sway over private companies such as Yahoo than a request from me that they remove material from their websites. Other avenues for combating contempt would include more formal reciprocal arrangements between governments, perhaps on a domestic legislation or international treaty-based approach. I would welcome any attempt to establish meaningful ways by which overseas contemptors can be held to account for creating undue prejudice to New Zealand trials or for damaging the integrity of the New Zealand court process. In conclusion, I'd like to emphasise the importance of making progress in this area. We have seen the power of the internet in creating potential prejudice in trials, and we are faced with an internet that is constantly evolving new ways to connect people and to share knowledge. We look forward to engaging with overseas authorities, governments, and internet service providers to find ways to manage contempt in an online world. The risk to fair trials through careless or intentionally improper statements made online can be substantial, ongoing, and not easily remedied, and it is incumbent upon all of us to produce creative solutions to this particularly unique problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I have a question to lead off. I think it was Yahoo, I may be wrong, but there was a case of, just looking at the extra-jurisdictional nature of the Yahoo, and it's based in the United States, and their reaction to your letter.
Yeah.
I believe that the French government was successful in getting Yahoo to take down a number of Nazi hate sites because it was opposed to French legislation, and that particular Yahoo did in fact remove them or block them. It seems to be some variance from your experience. So there is a... David, have you got a comment on that?
Just on that, and it might lead into my question, it was the German government, in fact, they were prosecuted under German law for allowing...
David, do you want to use mic?
The Yahoo executives were prosecuted under German law for allowing an auction in France to take place because Germany bans neo-Nazi and France doesn't. And that was quite concerning. Eventually it got overturned where the courts in Germany, I think, said, no, Yahoo's not liable unless it's targeted here. And if I can use this to perhaps ask a question of David, do you see any limits, perhaps in two ways, to your advocacy of respecting each other's legal systems? That firstly, is it just multinationals like Yahoo who you think should obey, for example, New Zealand law? Or do you also see if there's a small ISP in Amsterdam that your office approaches, they should also feel themselves obliged? And the second part is, do you see any limit on which assuming it's reciprocal, what countries should be there, because my great fear is that if every publisher has to obey the laws of every country, and I've just had a trip through Iran and the Middle East, you get the lowest common denominator where it would be quite stifling in terms of what you can and can't say.
I'm acutely aware of both of those problems, David. If we could get the principal ISPs, such as Yahoo, cooperating with New Zealand, I would regard that as a massive achievement. But I'm very, very mindful that if we've got an offender who's using Yahoo and Yahoo cooperates with us and takes or closes that offender down, and it's only going to take about 7 or 8 minutes for that person to pop up in Moldova or Panama or somewhere else where, you know, and we'd be just chasing them around the world for a very long period of time. The reality is that we're never going to be able to quash and squash determined and deliberate offenders if they are absolutely determined to go to Russia or go elsewhere and use the services of an ISP in those jurisdictions. But I think it would be a significant step forward if we were able to get agreement with major players, particularly in the United States. That I think would be a wonderful achievement, but it's not going to solve the problem. I'm acutely aware of that.
Yes, please.
Judge.
So, day for the David.
In the case involved two Jewish student organisations who brought proceedings in a court in Paris to stop Yahoo.fr, the French version of Yahoo, hosting the online auction. They were successful. They got their order. And furthermore, it was a condition of the order that they take steps to block the access to the auction through Yahoo.com. They employed Vint Cerf, among others, as their specialist, and they were able to shut down 90% access by French intermediaries, as the term was, to the Yahoo sites. And the situation stayed there. Furthermore, Yahoo was ordered to pay a significant fine. So Yahoo.com went to its home court in San Jose in California seeking a declaration that they not be liable to pay the fine, and there was a little jurisdictional argument about that, and the result was that the Americans said, yes, First Amendment rules.
Yeah.
So it was a win-win situation, the French one and the Americans one. Everybody was happy.
Okay, one more question before we break for... Yes, please, Lawrence.
Lawrence Miller here. I was just thinking, if you think through the long-term implications of going after the big people, then that's that. Does it not drive publication to jurisdictions that are outside of whatever community we have? So you end up with the similar effect for publishing as we have for capital. They move to... areas where the Bahamas or other places like that.
Yep.
And so you're not actually going to solve the problem that you're looking to solve. I mean, don't we need to look one level below that as to whether there is indeed a potential solution rather than just trying to deal with some of the more immediately presenting issues? So we've got a process at the moment that allows us to control print media to some extent. And what you're saying is that if you become as big as David Farrar's blog, then we'll try and control you. But if you're the size of Joe Nobody's blog, then we don't care. And over time, those are going to be the places where people go anyway for the information. So you're going to fail to do what you're looking to achieve.
Yeah, but I can't do nothing. that is part of the dilemma. And if you have any solutions as to what we can do to deal with what you call the second tier, then I'd be most interested. But at the moment, all I can see, the only way forward that I can see, And I don't for one moment say it's a solution, but the only way forward is to try and get cooperation out of responsible major players.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Simon.